You and I back together again, Thursday style, May 25th, 2023, on Connecticut Today. We featured a chat with Norwalk Mayor Harry Rilling on some proposed city zoning changes. Our buddy Lenny Grimaldi from onlyinbridgeport.com stopped by for his weekly update. We replayed Eric Erickson's interview with Florida Governor Ron DeSantis from earlier in the day, and I had some initial thoughts on Budweiser, Target, boycotts, and store violence. Right now, though, we're going to take some time here to talk about a topic that no matter where you live is always important: zoning. How a city or town is zoned, and a push to update the zoning regulations in the city of Norwalk. And joining us right now to chat about that, he's been on the show before, Norwalk Mayor Harry Rilling is with us. Mayor, good afternoon, sir. It's Paul. How are you?
Good afternoon, Paul. I'm fine. How about yourself?
I'm doing well, Mayor. Thanks for stopping by. We appreciate it. So, Mayor, some people may be following this. They may not be following this, you know, with some degree of import or not. But just to kick us off here, why is this happening? Why is the city looking, I guess, freshly at zoning? And how does that fit the overall vision of Norwalk?
Well, first of all, our zoning code has not been updated totally in more than 40 years, actually. And we did in 2019, we issued the plan of conservation and development for the city. And that plan recommended a complete rewrite of all our zoning because they're really outdated and hard to understand. And most importantly, not in line with modern practices.
Yeah, and I would imagine, Mayor, there's a lot of time that goes into that, to rewriting zoning codes, regulatory changes, and anything like this, as you well know, requires a certain amount of public feedback. How much have you had on that? Is there still a lot to come? And the timeline on all this, does the feedback process maybe extend the timeline out or not?
I don't think it's going to be necessary to extend the timeline because this month we began hosting a series of neighborhood-based public meetings to gather the community's feedback. So we went around to different parts of the city and held informational sessions so that people could get an idea of what we're trying to do and we could hear from them.
And Mayor, another concern that I know is out there, because I've covered this in other cities or towns, a lot of people say, okay, this is happening. What happens to my property? Commercial, residential, single family, multifamily, am I going to be nonconforming? Is there going to be a list available, say, of which properties may be nonconforming that have to be looked into further? What's the application on that?
Property exists in a conforming situation right now. If the zone is changed, they're grandfathered in, and we can't make them non-conforming and make them, and kick them off their property or make them do anything drastic. The main concern that we've heard is some neighborhoods are recommended to be converted from one family to two family.
Mm-hmm.
And some people don't know what impact that would have on their neighborhood. I looked at that, and I tend to agree with the feedback that we're getting, that we might be moving a little bit too quickly in that area. You don't want to make drastic changes because you really, this time around, we only get one chance to do it right. And we really have to listen to what the neighbors are talking about. But to give you an example, we had one person who was very concerned about the two-family zone and was very upset, only to be told that her neighborhood was zoned two-family since 2007.
Wow.
And nothing has changed. So it's not that there's going to be drastic changes, but I still think we need to step back, especially in the area of converting from one-family to two-family zones. I think we need to take a step back. Perhaps put that off to the side for now until we can get a better grip on it.
And a few more minutes on this Thursday afternoon with Mayor Harry Rilling, City of Norwalk, and we're talking about updates, the process underway to update the zoning regulations in the city. And the mayor notes in the first half of our chat that this really hasn't been done in a comprehensive way for decades. Mayor, thanks once again for joining us. Now, let's talk about housing and business zones. I know that's always a concern. Space for business uses here in those zones. How do you hash that out?
Well, this is not changing much of anything, except there'll be a very slight increase in allowed residential density along the Route 1 corridor in Norwalk. We want to try to establish a more mixed-use pedestrian environment along the corridor. So the city went through an in-depth rezoning of its industrial zones last year, and there are no changes in the draft zoning from what was approved.
Mm-hmm.
There are no proposed reductions in the amount of commercially zoned land. And many of the businesses zoned today permit residential as well as commercial. So it's just more or less making it more mixed use. And, you know, if you have a business in an area and you have residential in an area, it's kind of a good mix because you have a ready-made consumer base, if you will.
Is there, Mayor, any way that, say, somebody can go online or contact your office or wherever where they can look at numbers and charts as to what the present zoning is and, you know, versus, hey, these are the lines that may change or may not change, any of that?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't recommend anybody looking at what the current zoning presently is because it's so convoluted. It's just really outdated. And when I first retired from the police department, I was on the zoning commission for a bit. And for my orientation, they brought me in and gave me a stack of loose papers, probably about 8 to 10 inches high,
yeah,
and said, go ahead and read this and you'll know everything there is to know.
Wow.
So that's how complex they are and how outdated they are. So if they go online at our city website, norwalkct.gov,
okay,
they will be able to look at what some of the proposed changes are.
All right. Once again, online, people, spell it out, norwalkct.gov. Mayor Harry Rilling with us for a few more minutes talking about possible zoning changes that are underway for the city. Infrastructure, Mayor, sewers, water, electricity, gas lines, internet lines, the examination of that, will the proposed zoning changes be affected by any of those, or has that been taken into consideration?
No, I don't see any impact. You know, I hear a lot. I mean, Norwalk is on a Norwalk's on the rise. I know many people have noticed what's going on in Norwalk. We have a lot of people that are investing in Norwalk and moving into Norwalk. So there's been a lot of apartments built, which, by the way, are about 95% occupied. And our wastewater treatment plant has a capacity of over 18 million gallons a day, and we're nowhere near that. We're about 55 to 60% at capacity. The South Norwalk Electric and Water and the first taxing district, who are water suppliers to our city, will tell you that they're using less water now than they did 15 years ago because of the more efficient utilities and water conservation efforts. So I don't think that any of that is immediately in jeopardy.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of people hear that or have that concern, and I hear it a lot. So I try to correct that and try to make them feel more at ease.
Mayor, finally, you know, a lot of people, including me and you and obviously everybody who runs a city or town, is watching what's going on in Hartford, all the bantering about with affordable housing, yes or no, yay or nay. Any connection, Mayor, between these possible zoning changes and how that might affect future affordable housing in the city or any affordable housing stock? What do you think of that?
Well, we have an affordable housing policy that if somebody builds a unit of 20 or more or project of more than 20 or more units, 10% of those have to be affordable. And they either have to be on site or they can pay into our housing fund. So we are right now at about 13% affordable. I think most people know and understand that throughout the state of Connecticut, there's a severe housing shortage. And that also disrupts people's or businesses' ability to find suitable employees. So, you know, we have to look at overall what's happening throughout the state. We don't want people having to move out or not being able to move in. And so it's critical that our new zoning regulations set our community up for a future that helps ensure everyone who grew up in Norwalk wants to stay here and has access to proper housing that they can afford.
Mayor, finally, timeline on this. When would you like this to be completed, assuming that there will be more discussions and public input? But what are we looking at here in your best guess for a timeline here if everything shakes out the way you'd like it?
Well, first of all, I would encourage everybody to come or watch the Planning and Zoning Commission's upcoming public hearings. They're going to be on June 21st and June 28th at 6 p.m. And this way they'll be able to continue to hear from the public what's best and how they feel about the direction of our citywide zoning rewrite. I don't anticipate anything before the end of summer, because they're going to be looking at things over the summer, take all the feedback into consideration, and then they'll take a vote, or the Planning and Zoning Commission will take a vote. I've just mentioned to them, I've spoken to a couple of the commissioners, I don't want us to move too much too fast. And we need to strike the right balance as to what's fair. But Norwalk is unique. We have a lot of neighborhoods that have unique character, and a lot of people feel very strongly about that. So we want to make sure we listen to them, and we don't want to give them any undue concern that we're going to change the character of their neighborhoods, which we're really not.
As the mayor said, two key Planning and Zoning Commission meetings, June 21st to June 28th, both at 6 p.m. And, of course, go to the website, norwalkct.gov. Mayor Harry Rilling, City of Norwalk. Mayor, thanks. Good to chat with you again. You have our number, so don't hesitate to call. We'll talk down the road.
Thank you, Paul. Nice to talk with you, and have a great rest of the day and a good Memorial Day weekend.
Thank you, Mayor. Appreciate that. Mayor Harry Rilling, City of Norwalk. So again, you know, cities and towns, they go through zoning changes, folks. This is important stuff here. So if you're in Norwalk, if you live there, you have a business there, you may not live there, but you have a business, or if you live there, be informed. Planning and Zoning Committee meetings, the next two important ones, June 21st and June 28th, 6 p.m. Check them out either live or online, I would assume. And the website, norwalkct.gov. Now, what's always news is what goes on in Bridgeport. Of course, the website, onlyinbridgeport.com. And our buddy Lenny Grimaldi, the webmaster, the leader of all at onlyinbridgeport.com. Lenny, how are you this afternoon, sir?
Hey, Papa Pacelli, what's going on? Are we going to shut down Twitter today, you and I?
Yeah. This Twitter servers are going to crash because of me. Oh, man. Lenny, before we get to your fresh recap or fresh handicapping of the Bridgeport mayor's race, this new Q poll, now it's not likely voters, it's registered voters. However, Lenny, this is, you know, your old boss is still, he's not just breathing, he's alive there in a dead heat. How is this possible?
Well, I think because voters are now fixed on where they receive info. So the kind of information that you share with your audience, it's really balanced. You know, I mean, you don't take an extreme right or left point of view. You may lean a little bit right, others may lean a little bit left, but you have a nice balance in how you present information. But people are very, very fixed on where they're going to get their information. And, you know, what, you know, CNN is going to, and I think by and large, CNN does a good job, but what CNN is going to promote, right, or share with their viewers is going to be much different than what Fox News is going to share. I think people are very fixed on where they're getting their information. And that is really not going to change, you know, for a while. If you look at really even national elections of the last, you know, 20, 30 years, it's only when you go for national presidential polling, there's not a big flux. It's pretty consistent. It might be 3 points, 4 points, 5 points. You know, Biden did in 2020, you know, he won the national popular vote.
Oh, sure.
By I think about 7 or 8 million, right? But that really, I think it's only like 3 or 4 points, okay? And so I think that's one of the reasons. You know, also, you know, Trump isn't president right now, and he certainly doesn't have the platform that he had as president. And so I think that plays into it a little bit as well. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, Biden's polling numbers obviously are not strong either. But I think I think what this does, however, it provides someone like DeSantis a real platform. And he started this yesterday about we have to stop the culture of losing. And he's talking about in primaries because, you know, Trump's great in primaries, right?
Yeah.
And the people that Trump back are great in primaries, but not so great in a general election. I think he's going to start that. And, you know, let's face it. I mean, also, you know, Trump bubbled up a lot of anger in people when he was president. And that's still there. It's, you know, it's still very much there. I think that also plays into the national polls. You're not going to see much less. as you pointed out, he's probably going to get charged, you know, another one, two, or three times with something
four,
else.
Four, five, six cases.
Could be. it could be, you know. And so, you know, I'm not shocked about these poll numbers at all nationally. I think it's also early. You know, people, when you start getting into that cycle, you know, once the Republican and Democratic presidential primaries,
yeah,
when we turn the clock into 2024, people are going to start focusing a little bit more, and you know, we'll see how that shakes out.
All right, the focus though right now is on the Bridgeport mayor's race. Of course, the Democratic primary is essentially the general election. The endorsements coming up, and Lenny, you have chalkboarded. I like that, Lenny. Of course, they use, but everything now is those digital smart boards. But you've chalkboarded the mayor's race now at this point between the four major contenders. So, what should people know? What do you think the status is right now?
You're saying I gave away my age by chalkboarding, right?
Yeah, well, me too. Listen, Lenny, right? The heck with this high-tech stuff. A nice chalk and the clap in the erasers. That's what we need.
Yeah, we can do that. I mean, we're 2 months away from the Democratic Town Committee endorsement for mayor. And again, I'm, you know, it's the overwhelming favorite, you know, for that endorsement in July. So what happens next? Then there's a signature process to challenge the mayor of Democratic primary. And as you pointed out, you know, as you noted, it's the whole ball of wax in Bridgeport. It is the primary process. General elections are more like an afterthought on the local level anyway. And so, you know, I like to say that, you know, campaigns are all about dear old mom, money, organization, and message. Mm-hmm. You know, Ganim right now has all three going. This is a very different Joe Ganim than 4 years ago, when Maryland, State Senator Maryland, were, you know, scared the skivvies off of him in a Democratic primary. You know, he got caught napping, and I think right now he's definitely not taking it for granted. I haven't seen Ganim this engaged on the job really since the 1990s.
Really? Wow.
He's working like the Energizer Bunny. I've never seen it like him in a long, long time. I think what happened in 2019 kicked him in the pants. And he's working really, really hard. And he's also got a lot more going on, you know, developments in almost every neighborhood that mm-hmm. he can cite. The tax rate has been flat since he got back into office in 2015. Obviously, the amphitheater is a big deal. Mm-hmm. I think really probably the most important thing right now for Ganim, he's got stability in the police department under the leadership of Roderick Porter, who has been a godsend to him. You know, the first 6 months, Porter's really stabilized the department.
Yeah.
You know, on the opposition side, you know, you look at just the totality of the organization and money. You know, John Gomes is next. He's overperformed from my perspective in raising money. He's done a nice job there. He's also spent a lot too, because you know, although John Gomes was, you know, a chief administrative officer for the city and then assistant chief administrative officer, that doesn't necessarily lend itself to a wide profile.
Yeah.
So he's had to spend money building that up. And he's got some, you know, basically Gomes has a lot of the anti-Ganim interests that have gravitated to Gomes, right? So he's there. He's not going away. I think he probably has, you know, enough firepower to definitely signature his way into the primary ballot for September. And, you know, I think the messaging piece is missing for Gomes. He's got money, he's got an organization, but I think what he needs a stronger message to contrast himself with Ganim. Then you got the new guy, Lamon Daniels,
okay,
who was a Finch administration official. I think he overperformed in fundraising, he did pretty good in that. But we'll see if he flames out or hits a wall, because now, you know, early money is the easy money to raise. Now, this next quarter, you know, the quarter of April, May, and June, is critical to see what kind of money Lamon Daniels has raised. He has been the beneficiary of a lot of more supporters from 2019 who have gravitated to Daniels, which is good for him. So he does have some organizational strength. We'll see if he can keep the money strength going. And then you have State Senator Marilyn Moore, who did so well in 2019, who's really lagging in money,
yeah,
organization, message. You know, the thing about State Senator Moore, I mean, organization and Moore have never always been complementary. It's not one of her strengths, a structure and an organization. So she's going to have to, as I've said before, find another gear to really be relevant in this race. Now, in her defense, she's stuck in the legislature until for another, 10 days.
Yeah.
Because when you're in your legislature, you're stuck in a long session. It doesn't end until early June. So we'll have a better fix on the future of her mayoral ambitions. And if she really becomes a relevant, threat in the next couple of months. Right now, she's really, however, lagging behind.
Lenny, in three of the four people there, sans Marilyn Moore, because you said she's lagging behind, you kept talking about money, and of course, Joe Gannon with the most money, but, the other two gentlemen challenging him with the money there. And you say they're doing well money-wise. In this cycle, where is all that good money coming from? Do you see, Lenny, or hear about any differences in why there's been a boost in money here, or has there been?
Well, I think for Gomes, he's brought new money to the table. Gomes has really done well to reach out to interests in the Cape Verdean and Brazilian communities, contractors who've never really played on the political level. So he's brought new money to the table. A lot of that early money, it gets spent on campaign headquarters, mm-hmm. building infrastructure, consultants. Consultants get a lot, they're not cheap. And that's really important pieces in, building a platform for name recognition, because John Gomes isn't really that well known. He's going to start spending more money later on, as will Gannon. Gannon's going to outspend everybody by a lot.
Sure.
Because he's going to spend the last 2 months, and he'll have a lot of firepower. The question is, can Gomes keep up this fundraising pace? And can Lamont Daniels keep it up? So for Lamont Daniels, he did surprise. He did a pretty good job of fundraising. But, again, early money is the easy money. And the next couple of months or the next report comes out the first week of July, and we'll see if they hit a wall or they're continuing with strength in the fundraising areas.
All right. The website onlyinbridgeport.com. Check it out. Lenny's got a lot there, including he's chalkboarding the mayor's race for Democratic candidates as it stands right now. Lenny, always enjoyable. Take care. Have a good weekend. We'll talk to you next week.
All right. You too. Good weekend. See you next week.
Thank you, sir. There you go. Lenny Grimaldi, onlyinbridgeport.com, as he chalkboards. See, that's the generation Lenny and I come from, and maybe you chalkboarding the mayoral race. Marilyn Moore having problems, he says. The mayor out front, but, good, solid performances, especially in money so far from John Gomes and Lamont Daniels.
Joining me by phone, the governor of the great state of Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis. Governor, thanks very much for doing this. I know you are about to run out all over across the nation, and so spending some time with me, I appreciate it. Let me just ask you out of the gate, why yesterday start very non-traditionally, not a stage with a bunch of people behind you and before you, but starting on Twitter, congratulations, by the way, for breaking the internet, and something President Trump never did. Why start there as opposed to sort of the traditional rollout people expect?
Well, I think at the end of the day, there'll be times to do a lot of those speeches, and we've done speeches in front of a lot of people. We'll have time to do more. We've thought doing something with Elon, given his notoriety and cachet, and then given the fact that Twitter is now viewed as the place where you can speak your mind, as opposed to a lot of these other places, that it was an interesting opportunity. I had never done this Twitter Spaces before. I don't even have Twitter myself. Like the accounts we do are managed by our folks. And so I wasn't really sure how it worked. And, Twitter was talking about, we got it all locked. Everything's ready. They tested everything. But they just had so many people that swarmed it that it just basically melted the system. And so they were able to get that worked out. It was an interesting format. I think what's happened, though, is that these things live on. So that recording is now, I guess, available.
Yeah,
and there was a live stream one.
Now.
And I think there was like a live stream one that people have done, which has over 5.5 million now. So you're talking about probably by, later today, there'll probably have been over 10 million people to have watched that. So I think they were able to get a little bit different format. People were asking me questions. We were actually talking about different substantive issues in a way that a campaign rally just wouldn't do. But we will be doing a bunch of rallies. We'll be doing all that. But I think it was a unique opportunity, and I was glad we did it. I definitely think we got more buzz, and I think we got more interest as a result. I obviously know, just as somebody who's an elected official, most Republican primary voters, or heck, even a small percentage, probably aren't on Twitter. There's a very small percentage who actually are, and we understood that. But we felt that there would be a lot of buzz about it, and I think there has been, and I think it was probably the biggest story in the world yesterday. And so hopefully we'll get some people interested in our campaign who may not have been otherwise.
700,000 people, I was one of them, waiting, ultimately about 300,000 when they had to reboot the system. Couldn't pack those people into any stadium in Florida, I don't believe. So definitely a lot of people intrigued by this. Good fundraising numbers overnight as well. Let me pivot, though. If to the extent that Americans know you nationally from press coverage, they probably know about the issues with Disney or the parental rights and education legislation that the media derisively called the Don't Say Gay bill. But something I saw in the Wall Street Journal the other day, like 62% of Americans right now are struggling just to put food on the table, with food costs, paying rent, making ends meet. What do you tell those voters who they look at the issues they hear about in the media about what you're doing in Florida, but they're like, okay, but I don't know that I can pay rent this month because of the Biden economy?
Well, it's great you bring that up, because we address all those kitchen table issues every day in Florida. Just the legacy media just doesn't want to talk about it because it's not something that they can kind of twist in a negative light for me. So we just finished our legislative session, signed in all our tax relief. And so our view is Bidenflation is making it harder for people to maintain an adequate standard of living. We don't have income tax, so we can't cut that. But what can we do to help with that? So we just did $500 million in toll relief. So all of our commuters, they get a 50% rebate on their Sun Pass every month. That's going to save many of them hundreds of dollars this year, and some will may even be $1,000, because in South Florida, people could do a lot of tolls. We also did no tax on any baby item sales tax, so permanent exclusion. So if you have a baby, cribs, strollers, clothes, wipes, diapers, all of that. You know, we had a 2-year-old and a 9-month-old when I got elected in 18 and took office. And my wife, now we have a third, and they're all out of diapers. And she just said, why didn't you do this in January of 2019? We would have saved a lot of money, but you know, it is what it is. So we're doing things to really help families. We also did no tax on pet food and pet medication. And then we did things to help with some of the housing, because Florida, fortunately, we're a state people want to come. There's a lot of people that are moving here. We were open during COVID, so we had construction continue to pace, but at the same time, the demand has outstripped that. So we did a massive bill called the Live Local Act, which is really streamlining the ability to have attainable housing for people like cops and firefighters and teachers and other workers, so that they can live in their communities. And that is really moving forward very quickly. And so we're going to see a lot of good issues. But I think the fundamental economic issue is that these progressives are really regressive, because if you look at all the things that they've done, from the printing of the money at the Fed to spending all this money to their regulatory and bureaucratic policies, anti-energy, all these other things, they all have the cumulative effect of making it harder for working Americans to attain and maintain a good standard of living. And that's something that we would obviously address as president, but it's absolutely something we work very hard on in the state of Florida. It doesn't get the headlines. You're not going to read about it in the New York Times. MSNBC isn't going to do a package on how beneficial this is for Floridians, because it doesn't fit their narrative. But we're laser focused on all those issues.
I know, and in fact, I've mentioned this one time when you were on the show previously. I've got a friend who's a pretty progressive liberal, lives in Florida, actually commends you, speaks highly of what you've done economically, and also on conservation policy. He cares deeply, way more deeply, frankly, than I do about a lot of environmental issues. But one of the things that I think a lot of the people on the left talk about these days are these climate issues. You see polling that some Americans think it's more important than the economy. The left certainly does. And we see in Washington these policies, from whether it's gas stove regulations for emissions or the push to put people in electric vehicles. We don't have the lithium capacity to do it, to convert it. It's too expensive. And yet it seems like the left is consciously, from Washington, trying to price the middle class out of being able to live a mobile life in society and a life they can afford these days without scaling back because of the environment. I mean, what do you see as a way to confront that in Washington if you were elected?
Well, what I did in Florida was actually say, you know what, I can't control the climate. I am not doing mandates on any of that. In terms of environment, what I care about is the environment people enjoy. I want to conserve Florida, leave it to God better than we found it. So we just take an action to safeguard, and there's been infrastructure, water quality, all these different things, and people appreciate that because it's tangible. I think the left, you know, they're talking about all these other things. A lot of it is ideology. A lot of it justifies them to do policies that they would want to do anyways. Interestingly, in our tax bill, we did tackle the gas stoves. No tax on gas stoves now in Florida. We want to protect your gas stove. They claimed that they weren't going to go after it when the story first broke, and now, of course, we see they do want to go after the gas stoves. But I also think when you look at things like forcing people into electric vehicles, first of all, in Florida, when we had the hurricane, the EVs with the saltwater intrusion, they're more likely to catch on fire. Of course, if power's out, it's harder to be able to control your own destiny vis-a-vis a car powered by gasoline. You also have the situation of all the stuff that goes into creating this stuff, the batteries and everything going into an EV, is coming from China. So you're basically making us more dependent on China by forcing this conversion to EV. So we would reverse that under Biden. I have no problem if people want to buy an electric vehicle. I'm all about the market. But what they are doing, they're making automobiles less attainable for the average person. And you're right. Look at Germany's electric costs when they've gone down this road. It's way higher than a place like Florida. Look at California compared to red states, much higher. So you will absolutely have a lower living if the left gets their way. You know, the good thing is I think there's a pretty clear path to being able to reverse a lot of this stuff. The things he's doing through executive order, you could reverse right away. But even what they did with the Inflation Reduction Act, they passed that via budget reconciliation in the Senate. So with 50 votes, I think, we win the presidency. I'm pretty sure we would win the Senate and keep the House. And so in that case, what they put in by reconciliation, you could repeal by reconciliation.
Governor, last question for you. I want to be respectful of your time. I'm actually personal friends, as I mentioned to you, with the Haleys, with the Pences. I've known Tim Scott for a number of years, consider him a friend. You've got a sitting senator, potentially as a former vice president. You've got a former president, a former governor, UN ambassador. Why you, not them, for the presidency?
Well, we have a culture of losing in our party, and there's really no substitute for victory. We can't have any more excuses. We've got to get it done. And I think if you look at what we've done in Florida, I was able to take a state that was a swing state, a one-point state in 2018 and the previous decade, and then 4 years later win it by 20 points, 60% of Hispanics, winning independents by 18%. And so that's the direction we need to go to be able to win nationally. But I'm the only one that's taken all these great conservative principles we all share, the values, the ideas, taking all of those and making them a political reality in Florida and winning big day after day. There's a lot of talk about, oh, we're going to do all these things, and then Republicans oftentimes don't convert on it. And I don't think there's anybody in the modern history of the party that's been able to transform a state the way we have. And I don't think anybody's been able to put the points on the board that we have. So I think people could say, and I've made the promise, if you nominate me, I will get it done. I will be taking the oath of office on January 20th, 2025 at high noon. And then we will spit nails from day one. I will use all the authorities that we have to bring about a really strong, bold agenda. And it'll be a two-term project when you're talking about the bureaucracy and all these other things. But I think I've proven that when I say I'm going to do something, I'll do it. And people will know I'll be able to get the job done.
Governor, I know you've got a whirlwind tour ahead of you. Thank you for spending some time with us. Best of luck on the campaign trail.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it. If anyone wants to help out, just go to rondesantis.com.
Thank you very much. Governor Ron DeSantis, now headed to Iowa and New Hampshire after making a lot of media rounds over the next couple of days.
So I've told you over and over and over again, and I'll continue to tell you this, I'm torn when it comes to boycotts. And I honestly am. I'm not saying this for effect. I'm not saying, you know, hey, it's 208. I got to come up with something edgy to start the show. No, I'm just being normal with you. I'm just trying to tell you how I feel on something like this. And, you know, there's that old phrase that if you don't like what a company is doing, if you don't like how a company is comporting itself, if you don't like what a company stands for, then you choose, and sometimes you try and get people to rally around your quote-unquote flag, you choose to not spend your money there, hoping that if you do that enough, it'll maybe tell or get said company or said, major conglomerate or whatever to rethink what they're doing. Now, the reason I say I'm torn about that is because the people it's going to hurt are not the ones at the top initially. Eventually, it may rise to the top there, and even if it gets there, a lot of those people at the top have a decent enough amount of wealth that it just might not hurt them. And I don't like boycotts generally because they tend to affect the worker or the individual kind of at the bottom of the food chain first. I mean, you're seeing that now with the Budweiser and Bud Light and Anheuser-Busch thing because of the marketing agreement they had and that one post sent out by Dylan Mulvaney. I mean, we're hearing about bartenders, restaurants, waiters, waitresses being compensated by folks, because of folks steering away from Anheuser-Busch products. So it's not the restaurant presidents or the big retailer heads that are getting hurt by this at the moment. It's the person at the bottom of the food chain. So now we have another one here. So we heard about Budweiser, right, and Anheuser-Busch because they made some custom cans, of Bud Light, and say it for what it is. Bud Light is Bud Light. It's not a real highbrow beer. But if you're in a bar and you don't have a lot of money, hey, give me a Bud or a Bud Light. Okay, I get that. And we saw what happened there with the whole Dylan Mulvaney thing. But now we have another one here. And I'm wondering again, is this fair? I don't know whether you've heard this. And by the way, I want you to, chime in on this. Love to hear your thoughts on this. Because as around here, in Fairfield County, in New Haven counties, in Connecticut, our great state of Connecticut, there's plenty of Budweiser and Bud Light to be enjoyed and savored, and a lot not to be enjoyed and savored, if, that's what you prefer, right? So now we have the latest episode of this, and it's not with a beverage, it's not with a food, it's not with a car company. It's not with a fast food, company like, say, Chick-fil-A. There are people I know who still won't eat it, Chick-fil-A because of the family ownership's position on gay marriage, at least in the past. This one is concerned with a retailer that is all over the country and has several locales here in Connecticut. Target or Target. as some people like to say. Target, though, right? Everybody, and you know, Target battles with Walmart, and they battle with other stores. So it's kind of one of these mid-level stores. I think Target fancies itself, you know, maybe a half a step or a step above Walmart. Well, get this now, and you have the boycott question here, and you have the question of whether or not we're losing our collective minds with this transgender thing, and whether or not corporate America is feigning some sort of concern, some sort of real social empathy for people who may feel they're transgender. Is that just a bunch of bull crap because they see an opportunity to make money? And I always say to you, be careful when companies all of a sudden step up out of nowhere and say, hey, we would love to serve this market because they're challenged, and we understand that we want to be the retailer of choice. No, you want to make money is what you want to do, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. America is America. A capitalist system is a capitalist system, and I'm sure there are people at many businesses and concerns who sit in boardrooms and they say, hey, let's jump on this. Even if we're only on it for a little bit, we'll throw some, you know, shelf space at it or some rack space. We'll get written up. Doesn't matter whether it's good or bad. You know, it's that old phrase, there's no such thing as bad PR. What's that other phrase that you hear from time to time if you're in retailing and marketing? Just spell my name right. I guess that came from the old Hollywood days or TV or music PR. Just spell my name right. I don't care whether you think my album is crap or my TV show is crap or my movie sucked. Who cares? Just, okay, you spelled it right. Fine. It's like this show. You can love it, you can hate it, but it's PACELLI. Dot the I. There you go. Target has lost, get this, Target has lost 9 billion with a B, kids, not with a T, not with an M, $9 billion in market value since angry social media users called for a boycott. So that means maybe the Target stores right here in Connecticut are maybe getting hit with this. So what's the boycott all over? You're saying, well, wait a minute. Target's a clothing store. You know, they have other hard goods in there. You may say, hey, I go to Target. I go to the Target in, you know, you may say, I know there's one in North Haven. I think there's one in Stratford. There's probably Targets all over the state. If you look for a, you know, store locator, as they say on their websites in Connecticut. Target stock a week ago was $161 a share. So that made the whole company worth $74 billion. That's a lot of money. But early trading today, this morning, when the market's open, Target was at $141.76, and that lowered their total market cap by $9 billion. That is a 12% drop in value. So why are people upset? And my bigger question here is this fair to the company? Is it fair to the workers? Now, again, going from $74 billion to $65 billion, $65 billion is still a lot of cake, okay? Target ain't shutting down anytime soon. But, you know, the stock took a hit, $19 a share, and that means if somebody had, you know, 100 shares of stock, even I could do that that math. It's $1,900. Now, again, it'll probably bounce back. But the two things I want to look at this is why is Target getting targeted here? And is it their own fault? And are they just hopping on the bandwagon here because it's kind of chic? And I'm sorry I have to use that word, but it really is. Is it kind of chic to jump on the transgender bandwagon and say, oh, I care. I want to serve the transgender community. Because I'm wondering, and I have to be delicate how I say this, but in all honesty, is the segment of the population that believes it's transgender, is it that big that major retailers have to jump on this? Or is this just another callous corporate kind of, hey, it'll make us look good? And by offering what they're offering, and we'll get into certain clothing here in a moment, by offering what they're offering here, is this playing with kids' minds? Because kids see this, right? Kids might see some of these clothing offerings, and they may say, well, wait a minute. Maybe, yeah, hey, I'm going to go with this because, hey, they're making clothes for it. So isn't this cool? Is it hip? So one of the world's biggest retailers, Target, has taken a $9 billion hit. And this is my point. Are we overreacting to this a little bit? Or is this America? Are these people... is this America saying, hey, listen, stop normalizing something by being callous and opportunistic here? So what Target was doing, if you didn't hear this, in certain areas, they were putting out there what are called tuck-friendly swimsuits. You know, kind of a one-piece swimsuit here. What do you mean tuck friendly? Well, and I'm not being flip here. This is what this means. And this has now cost Target nine, with a B, in their market value, $9 billion. $9 billion. Tuck friendly swimwear is swimwear that is designed to be worn by a biological male who identifies as female, and how could I put this gently? It allows that biological male to, tuck his genitalia into some sort of a pocket, some sort of a pocket kind of stitching in the crotch area to make it look like he is a girl or a woman. And apparently they were displaying this at some stores. Now, here's where people are getting it wrong. You can question this and say, hey, what are you putting this stuff out there for? This is a serious subject. This is not a mainstream condition people have. Whether you want to call it identifying as transgender, which is fine. You want to call it gender dysphoria, whatever. But the problem is here now, you have people going into Target, and instead of maybe just turning away, and even if you don't like it, maybe shake your head and say, eh, look at that, and walk to the back of the store and do what you came in to do or get what you wanted to get. Instead, you even have some people going into these stores and vandalizing those displays. Now, I understand people are passionate about this. There are allegations out there by some who say, well, doing stuff like this just grooms young boys to think they're girls at a young age. To put out the advertising material about this takes a very serious subject here and kind of molds it into something that you can make a few dollars or cents on. So I understand people are maybe angry about that, but you can't vandalize stuff. You can't. And again, going back to the boycott here, you know, taking $9 billion away from a company's total value, even in the short term, is going to have some problems. And why would you do that when you can just walk into the store and not have to buy what you don't want to buy and go ahead and make a purchase? go to a register that's far enough away from these tuck-friendly items, and then leave. So I understand the power of the pocketbook or the power of the wallet. I get it. But the vandalism, no. And costing a company billions of dollars, I'm torn on that. Now, you may remember Target's boss said, no, we're going to do this. And all of a sudden, when he saw the stock price and the sales start to drop, he changed his tune. And now they're saying, quote, given the volatile circumstances, we're making adjustments to our plans, including removing items that have been at the center of the most significant confrontational behaviors. Target said customers knocked down pride displays at some stores, angrily approaching workers and posting threatening videos on social media from inside the stores. Target CEO Brian Cornell had previously defended the LGBTQ plus friendly merchandise and the tuck friendly merchandise.